be number 201486, Lambran versus Faye Servicing LLC.
Good morning. My name is David Feynman. I represent Charles and Tracy Lamoran, the plaintiffs below and the appellants herein. We're here today asking the court to reverse the lower court's ruling on dismissal of the Lamoran's consumer protection claims against Faye Servicing, the defendant. Because we're here on a review of a motion to dismiss, we get to look at everything in this case with fresh eyes. And all the acts that have been alleged by the Lamorans are going to be viewed in the light most favorable to them. Facts are relatively straightforward. Faye Servicing is the Lamorans' default mortgaging servicer. During a state court foreclosure case and prior consumer claim, a settlement between those two were reached, whereby Faye agreed to reduce the balance due on the mortgage, waive all attorney's fees that were incurred, and give the Lamorans 12 months in their home in order to try to get refinance, redemption, deal with the outstanding balance in some way. In exchange, the Lamorans dropped their prior claims against Faye Servicing and consented to that foreclosure judgment. Subsequently, Faye Servicing began sending billing statements that demanded an amount due that was outside and above the consented final order judgment to the tune of $15,000 more on the principal and $25,000 in attorney's fees, despite those being waived as part of the settlement.
I'm going to jump in since I think we're familiar with the facts of the case. Do you think that there are any circumstances where a periodic statement required under the Truth in Lending Act wouldn't count as debt collection activity?
Well, and that was going to be the primary issue of this case, is that this case was decided that it was not, the billing statements were not sent in connection with the collection of a debt, and it was decided in a dismissal of a pleading stage, and I think that's highly inappropriate for what the issues involved here. I think it's unfortunately the way the courts are trying to, in many cases, because the cases, there's a litany of them that go different directions like a tennis ball sometimes in the same district, and I think the reason for the problem that we're seeing in these divergent cases between judges is because it's not a dismissal issue. It's an affirmative defense to raise a bona fide error or that they're relying on an advisory opinion by the CFPB, which is the agency charged with promoting rules and regulations under the FDCPA. And in order to show that affirmative defense, they've got to show that they in good faith relied upon that advisory opinion. You can't do that on a dismissal motion. There's no evidence to be considered yet. So the courts make a couple of mistakes when they decide these issues on dismissal. Number one, they elevate TILA, Truth in Lending Act, above the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And there's no analysis whatsoever about whether Congress impliedly intended to preempt the FDCPA by TILA. And I don't think that they did, because compliance with both can be had. Quite frankly, a TILA statement requires only information on the mortgage to be given to the borrower, such as the principal balance, the interest rate, escrow balances, where the loan is sitting, basically. It doesn't require billing statements. Congress wasn't trying to rectify a problem with mortgage companies not sending billing statements. Sure, that was happening. So what ultimately happened is once TILA came down.
Can I ask the question
sure.
This way? If the statements they had sent looked nothing other than what the model statement issued by the CFPB said you could do, the district court, in your view, would be correct that you couldn't state a claim here because you couldn't show that they were a debt collector involved in a debt collection activity, right?
If the statements were purely informational.
If the statement.
Correct.
Just looked like the statement that the CFPB put out and said no more, it would not be a debt collection activity, and the district court would be correct to grant a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. Isn't that correct?
I would argue in this case that would not be correct.
No, I thought your argument would be, that's true, Judge, but in this case they did so much more than what the model statement permitted.
And I think I was going to say that in another way, Your Honor. What I would say is if the information on that statement was correct, the amount due was correct, yeah, and all it was
what if
was...
What if it's the amount is incorrect, right? But, hold on, the amount is incorrect, but the paper says nothing about paying the amount, nothing about here's an envelope to pay, nothing about here's the website you can go to. It just says, Dear Lamarins, here's how much you owe. Here are the other things required by TILA, and that's it.
So I think the analysis would then turn is, what is this in connection with the collection of a debt? Again, let's take the real clean example, and that is the amounts are correct, everything's correct. It's just an informational statement. There's really no violation there, potentially. It can still have a dual purpose, but I think what you have, again, if we analyze at the dismissal phase, it's really hard to understand how this statement showing an amount due can't have another purpose, a dual purpose. What I think would be the proper mechanism in that situation is an affidavit saying, we complied with the CFPB, we looked at it, we formatted the statement as a result of it, and we in good faith relied upon it. Summary judgment, the judge says they have a defense under the FDCPA, which has proven that they in good faith relied upon the advisory opinion of the CFPB. That's where I think the problem with in connection being so broad, you're going to have situations where if you try to extrapolate mortgage statements from any other situation where a creditor or debt collector sends a statement of an amount due, case law just goes two different ways on it and it becomes very confusing because it's not a dismissal phase issue.
What does it matter what they relied on if the statement is exactly the same as the model form that's been approved by the CFPB?
Well,
I mean, can't you just look at that and tell that it's the same?
It's not the same.
Yours isn't, just so we're clear.
Correct.
So we're not asking you to concede that yours was fine. It's just
correct.
In a different case, if it were just like the model, why is that a debt collection action?
Again, it's a matter of the reason that they can rely on that is because the FDCPA gives a defense, a statutory defense to these claims. But that also requires a proof of a good faith reliance on the opinion. And so, it's problematic on a dismissal phase because, on a dismissal motion, because the court really can't go outside the pleadings. And if there's no allegation...
But why is the court going outside the pleadings if all they did was send a statement that was modeled exactly on the CFPB model? Whether it was correct or incorrect, the issue here is whether or not it was a debt collection activity.
Because, whether they have the defense is fine, but I don't think you can say it's not debt collection. The CFPB wouldn't even give an advisory opinion if it did not think these statements were debt collection. There would be no reason to opine on this. It is in connection with debt collection. And the other point is, the CFPB is only addressing when cease communications requests are made, that provision of the FDCPA. It's not determining, it says proper use of this form must be used. In this case, there was no proper use. We have improper amounts demanded, and attorney's fees that were waived. So again, I think on a clean case, again, dismissal, it becomes very hard to say it's not in connection with debt collection. It absolutely is in connection. It's a very broad phrase that Congress used, and it's a liberal statute since it's remedial. And I don't think that analyzing it, I think you go down some really obscure rabbit holes to try to say it's not in connection with debt collection. I think the proper analysis to avoid any type of liability for a debt collector or a mortgage servicer is to say it's in connection, but you have a defense. I don't think you can say it's not in connection with debt collection because that term is so broad. And that's why we get these cases that go so many different directions. And it's not done by the numbers. My time is rolling, so it's the finals. Unless anyone has any questions, I'll save the remaining time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lauren Raines, and I represent the appellee, Faye Servicing. As my esteemed colleague mentioned, this case turns essentially on whether the monthly statement that was sent by Faye can be construed as a debt collection communication or is merely informational in nature. That is the crux of the issue that I believe we're here on today.
When the statement says amount due in a large bold font and then a payment due date, right? And then a different place it says you must pay this amount to bring your loan current. And failure to bring the account current may result in additional fees or expenses. And in certain instances, you may risk the loss of your home to foreclosure sale. And then, in all caps, detach and return bottom portion with your payment. Would a reasonable person or even an unreasonable person think, oh, that's just a notification. They're not trying to collect my debt.
Well, I think that before we get to whether or not it was the least sophisticated consumer standard, we have to first look at the statement, as you indicated, on its whole and determine, someone looking at this, would they determine this is debt collection or not? And I think in order to answer that question, the courts have said, let's look at what the model statement prescribes as what should be included, and that should be our starting point for what should be, what a reasonable person should determine should be included in the monthly statement. And in this particular case, the Faye Servicing statements that were sent did comply substantially with what the model form requires and mandates.
Well, sure, but does including the bare minimum amount of information give you a get-out-of-jail-free card for not complying with the Truth in Lending Act?
Well, when you say not complying with the Truth in Lending Act.
The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, I mean?
So I don't think it, I think if you comply with the TILA model rule and the requirements that are set forth on TILA, but what needs to be in the statement, and then you do comply, then I believe that is the threshold question that needs to be answered first. And if you do that, then I believe it is, as a matter of law, exempt from a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act violation.
So where do you get that from the Act? Speaking for myself, I don't quite see why complying with TILA gets you out of the FDCPA.
It's coming from the cases, and I think it's coming from, it starts with this court, the 11th Circuit, that going all the way back to the Reese decision in 2012, where the court examined default notices sent by a law firm that had a lot of threatening language that said all within them that they were debt collection notices, and that amounts needed to be due or collection action would take place, and they were sent by law firms. And in that instance, the 11th Circuit held that was a debt collection notice. Then we got to the Carrasas case in 2014, which was the debt validation notice also sent from a law firm that said repeatedly it was a debt collection letter, it was being sent to collect a debt. And while it did have potentially another purpose of being a pre-suit required notice, there were so many instances within the letter of demands for payment immediately that it was to be construed a debt collection notice, although it did not actually give rise to liability under the FDCPA under the least sophisticated consumer test. Then that brings us to Green. And Green, while unpublished, I think follows the holdings of the published decisions out of the 11th Circuit, analyzes the monthly statements, like we have in this case, under the lens of whether or not it goes beyond what TILA requires, and says if it doesn't and if it conforms.
So
with
I'll stop you there because we've talked with counsel a lot this week in many different cases about the fact that our unpublished cases are not binding. So
I understand.
I think for me at least, I would set Green aside entirely and say what in our precedents, our published precedents, the Supreme Court's precedents, or most importantly, what in the statute says, just because you comply with the requirements of TILA means that you can do whatever other dishonest means of debt collection might be prohibited by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, but because you've complied with TILA, you're out of all those requirements.
Well, I think it's the notion that the statement is being provided for another purpose, right? For the informational purpose. It's not being provided to deceive someone. It's not being provided for the purpose to collect the debt, but it's being provided to provide the consumer, who in this case in particular was post-judgment but pre-sale, with information to potentially reinstate the loan or redeem the property.
This type of position that on a TILA notice, you can say literally anything else you want, and no matter how misleading that other statement is, there's no possibility of being held accountable under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position. I believe that there are instances, this is a model form, and loan servicers or banks or whoever can, of course, go beyond the form, and they can make their statements much stronger. They can include much more serious demands for payment, threats for, you know, serious action, big, bold, you know, notices of we're going to come after you, we're going to report you for bad debt, things to really frighten someone potentially and appear as if they're truly trying to collect the debt versus giving the consumer information on how to reinstate the loan or redeem the property, which they're required to provide under TILA and the consumer may not otherwise have access to. So I don't believe that every single statement, no matter what, would be per se not debt collection, but I believe that if the statement follows the TILA prescribed standards and contains the information that TILA says should be in the statement, including in this case the detachable bottom section, which doesn't say, you know, big bold payment coupon, it just says please detach and has an address just like the one in the model form. I believe in those instances these statements should not be held to be debt collection and should be viewed as informational and serving another important purpose under a different section of the code.
So you're saying that some TILA compliant notices could violate the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, but that the one issued by your client to the Lamarins did not.
That's correct.
All right, well, help me with what you actually did send. Because when I lined up the mortgage statement that Faye Servicing sent over a number of months and compared it to the mortgage statement in the model form, I see a whole lot more in your statement than I see in the model statement. And so the question for me becomes whether what you said in your form might be reasonably characterized as debt collection activity. So let's just talk about the differences that I see. The model form in no place says that the company is actually a debt collector. It doesn't say Springside Mortgage, which is the form, is a debt collector. But when I look at your statement on page 2, you say at the bottom of the page, Faye Servicing LLC is a debt collector. Second, you say, and this is not in the form, and the information you provide to us will be used for that purpose. So now you've gone beyond the model statement to identify yourself as a debt collector and to tell the mortgagee that the information you provide us will be used for that purpose. Those seem to be different. Third, you say in the very same paragraph on page 2, to the extent your original obligation was discharged or subject to an automatic stay under the bankruptcy code, this, referring to the statement that's being sent, is being provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an attempt to collect a debt or impose personal liability. Of course, the inference is obvious that it would constitute an attempt to collect a debt unless the original obligation was discharged, which it was not in this case, or unless it was otherwise subject to an automatic stay under the bankruptcy code, which it is not either. So I might pick this up and say, looks to me like, A, they've told me they're a debt collector, B, they've told me any information I send will be used for debt collection purposes, and C, this is not just informational given the facts in this case. All of that goes far beyond anything in the mortgage statement in the model. And then finally, at the top of the second page, you lay out in living color, in great detail, to the mortgagee how to go about making a payment. You can pay by phone, you can pay by overnight or express mail. If you want to pay by phone, here's what you have to do. If you want to pay online, here's what you have to do. If you want to pay in a MoneyGram Express payment, here's what you have to do. So when I pick this form up, it looks to me like it is very different from a garden variety form that simply reflects what's in the mortgage statement. Might not the least among us pick this up and consider this to be some kind of effort to collect a debt? That it's more than, it's surely informational, but it has a thrust that goes beyond purely informational. Why would that be an unfair or incorrect reading from the statement that you provided to the mortgagee on multiple occasions?
Well, I think with respect to the debt collector language, it's a nuanced argument, but the statement doesn't say specifically like this is an attempt to collect a debt, which is sort of the hallmark of what you see in a lot of other cases where a court may have found that that is a factor weighing in favor of debt collection. And this court in the Farquharson versus Citibank case actually made that distinction in the language, whether it was the letter, in that case it was a letter that was being looked at for debt collection purposes. And there was a notation in that case that the letter didn't specifically say it was an attempt to collect a debt, but it was instead just referring to the sender as a debt collector, which under the FDCPA there is a requirement that the sender identify itself as such. And there's always a competing interest in trying to comply with one section and then potentially being scrutinized for doing so in the context of a different section violation.
What about the sentence that follows the statement that we're a debt collector and any information you send us will be used for the purpose of collecting a debt? Well, what is somebody to make of the second sentence?
It is an inference at best that it is.
At best, isn't that a fair inference to draw, the one that I raised?
I think that it's fair, but it's not overt. It's not as overt as some of the other examples that we've seen in cases where it was clear that there was debt collection.
But they're saying it would be informational if it fell into category A or B. But we know this mortgagee doesn't fall into category A or B. Otherwise, the inference is pretty strong that it's not informational. If it's not informational, the only other possibility is that it's debt collection, right? Isn't that a pretty strong inference that one might draw?
I think it is an inference that one might draw. I would just distinguish it from a direct disclaimer.
I think that's right. I don't think it's quite direct, but I have to connect two dots to get there, whereas what you're talking about is a single bullet point. What about the top of the page, which goes on for four or five paragraphs, and lays out how the mortgagee is supposed to go about paying the debt, payment by phone, payment online, MoneyGram Express payment. Why would you put that in a form if it was not designed and intended to tell the mortgagee, hey, here's how you go about making your payments, make a payment to us?
Right. I mean, in this particular instance, and I think with a lot of servicers and a lot of the billing statements that we've seen in these cases, you do see these payment options because the billing statements are the only statements that go out on a monthly basis, these periodic statements. So they contain the information that is otherwise helpful for someone if they were to want to make a payment.
But it's not in the, it's not clearly, it's nothing like that's in the model form, right?
I don't believe this payment information is in the model form, no.
And there's nothing in, when I looked at the requirements of Regulation Z, you've got to show the amount due, the explanation of the amount due, the past payment breakdown, the transaction activity, contact information, delinquency information. None of the things that appear on page two, I don't think, are required by Regulation Z.
Other than that it is in fact the contact information, you know, for
correct.
The servicer. I mean, that is what this is. It's providing the information on how to contact your servicer, the phone number and the address, and the email or website. And the, you know, I just will say that the other courts that have looked at these statements, they all are, you know, virtually identical in the sense that they do include this type of kind of what I'll call boilerplate information on how to make a payment that's typically included in all periodic statements that are sent out.
I had just one other question about the form, and it was already touched on a little bit. If you go to page one, even with the detachable portion, if you look at the model, mm-hmm. it just has a line, and then it just says amount due, Springside Mortgage, and the box, post office box. This one, however, is interesting because it goes beyond that, and it's a nice touch. What you say is, detach and return the bottom portion with your payment. What is the recipient of this form supposed to infer from a statement that you're going to detach this bottom portion with your payment, and then it says the amount due is $92,789, and the accelerated amount is $101,000, and it's got the due date. If I picked it up, I confess to you, it looks to me like I might have thought I'm supposed to pay this sum or some sum to face servicing. Would that be an unfair and incorrect reading?
I don't think so, and I don't think that even with the model form that would be an incorrect reading. I mean, I think that
right.
the form does have this detachable, you know, essentially a coupon, whether they don't call it a coupon, but I think that would be a reasonable inference for one to make. It doesn't say in bold or all over, you know, please pay payment coupon, but it you know, it is a detachable portion.
Right. It doesn't say return bottom portion with your payment, but you're right. It is detachable. Does this model form, and this gets back to a question that my colleague was asking you earlier, mm-hmm. does this model form have any effect or force of law?
I'm sorry. Can
does
you
it have any legal effect?
Does the model form have any
yeah,
legal
I mean,
effect?
The CFPB put it out. Suppose the CFPB put out a form that was exactly the same as the form you put out.
Mm-hmm.
Would I then be obliged to say this is not debt collection activity, given what the statute says and Regulation Z says?
If the CFPB promulgated this form and said you had to use this form, and you did.
The form that they offered this as a form, the form you actually used, which mm-hmm. goes far beyond their model form.
Okay, I see what you're saying. If this was the form.
Would I give any effect to the CFPB's promulgation here? The model form wasn't, there was no notice, and opportunity to respond. This was just what they did. So they read the statute wrong.
I mean, I think that one should give effect to a form that's promulgated. And I also, I believe that our form, while it does have some deviations, I don't think it rises to the level of being so egregious or so...
Right, I understand. Am I Chevron bound to follow the form? Or am I hour bound to follow the form, looking at the normal kinds of rules, at least, that exist at this point?
The CFPB is guidance. I mean, it's not, you're not bound to follow the form.
See, I think I'm bound to follow probably Regulation Z.
But
I think that's in a very different category than the form. That's all I was really asking, the distinction between the model form on the one hand and Regulation Z, which was promulgated extensively after notice and comment and so on.
Yes. No, I see what you're saying now. I mean, I think that under TILA, the form is there for guidance, and there is, you know, there is an underlying, I think, policy consideration of trying to give servicers some leeway, some rein, so they can send out notices and not have a fear of being sued every time they send out every notice. And in connection with monthly statements in particular, they're sent out so frequently, once a month, throughout the life of a loan. So it gives endless opportunities for potential litigation if there is a perceived, and we don't necessarily concede that there was an error in this one, but if there's a perceived error, it could be an interest rate, a late fee, whatever it may be, an accounting issue with a statement. And if there's basically just sort of any time anyone perceives there's an error with the statement, the answer is file an FCCPA case or file an FDCPA case. The amount of litigation over these statements would be, you know, exponential. There are other ways in which this can be remedied. There is RESPA, which allows a borrower to call and dispute if they think there's something wrong with the statement. But this could also lead to other informational statements being construed as debt collection. You could have ARM notices. You could have escrow change notices, which are supposed to be informational in nature, now being disputed as having information that is misleading. And we're going to see another, you know, influx of litigation over these types of cases. So
I'm having trouble understanding your argument then, because I thought that you said before, in response to my question, that it was possible for a statement that was sent based on a Truth in Lending Act requirement to also, in some circumstances, violate the FDCPA, but that your particular statement did not. But it sounds like now you're saying, if we look at any TILA, TILA compliance statement for FDCPA violations, then that's a Pandora's box problem, so we just shouldn't do that. Those seem like two different arguments to me.
They aren't necessarily two different arguments. I mean, I don't view them that way. I view them as, you know, one of the arguments is, look, you need to follow the TILA guidelines, and you shouldn't include statements or demands in the TILA statements that, say, look like a Reese demand or a Carasas demand. And if you do that, then you're no longer necessarily within the safeguard of TILA. And if you're within the safeguard of TILA because you haven't stepped over the boundaries in a way that's considered truly kind of a harassing debt collection language, then you should be given some protection, and the servicers should have some protection in that regard for the monthly statements that they have to send out. I know we've gone over. If no one has any questions, I very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
So as I listened to my opposing counsel's argument, a couple times I heard that, you know, the FA servicing puts these billing processes in there because they do want to have the opportunity to have borrowers pay their bills. They effectively are admitting it has a dual purpose when they send these out. So I want to kind of retract a little bit and go back into the CFPB questions that were fielded to me earlier, because I outlined, I think, the thoughts that I was trying to get out to the questions that were posed. The CFPB initiated this form and these rules that it put out because of the question that arose with servicers' requirements under TILA and compliance with the FDCPA, because they recognize that these statements are billing statements that are sent in connection with the debt. And so under 1692, I think it's K, they use their authority under the statute to develop an advisory opinion of how a servicer can handle a situation when a consumer says, I don't want to see these statements anymore. Big problem was happening with bankruptcy cases. I don't want to see these statements anymore. I'm done. I filed for bankruptcy. I don't want to see these anymore. And they kept getting them, and suits started happening. So the CFPB started these regulations and put something in place for servicers that can comply with TILA without necessarily, in their opinion, violating the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It didn't find that these things were not in connection with the collection of the debt. What it said was, if you do it this way, you're going to have a defense to the claim. To answer to Judge Marcus's question, the CFPB is not binding on this court. That's the whole premise. If it gets it wrong, the defendant in an FDCPA case can still have a defense and say, I relied in good faith on the CFPB.
Right, but I thought your argument would be, even if the model form got it right, what they did went so far beyond the bounds of the model form that a reasonable person would construe that as being debt collection activity.
And that's precisely where I'm going next, Your Honor. This form is so far beyond the CFPB form, and I think it was even mentioned by my opposing counsel, trying to comply with two statutes. Well, why are you trying to comply with the FDCPA if you're not trying to collect debt? There's no reason to. You just follow the TILA form from the CFPB. Don't put anything else in it. You don't have to worry about the FDCPA because you're not trying to collect debt. But they went out of their way to put this extra information in, payment information in, and FDCPA required text that this is from a debt collector attempting to collect a debt. All information be used for that purpose. That mini Miranda type language expressly required by the FDCPA. Why do you put that in there if you're not collecting debt? It doesn't make sense. So I think what we have here is we do have an absolute dual purpose statement that is sent in connection with the collection of debt. And it's not even within the realm of why the CFPB put this statement out, which if you look at the reasons for these statements, it's not just a blanket, send this TILA statement out and you're good with the FDCPA. That's only for the cease communication provision. CFPB imagines that you're going to give proper information in this statement because otherwise all usefulness of the statement is gone because the CFPB is saying that you're sending these because it's helpful to the borrower. When you're demanding or saying that they owe incredibly more amounts than what they do owe and including charges that are improper, that's not protected by sending it on these statements because you're running afoul of a different provision of the FDCPA than what these statements were put out for, if you look at what the reasons behind those, of when those statements can be sent without worrying about violations.
Can I ask you a question about the model form?
Yes, sir.
The model form has what looks like a detachable thing. It says Springside Mortgage, it has the address, it says amount due, and then at the bottom it says make check payable to Springside Mortgage. Is that an attempt to collect a debt, in your view?
I believe that is in connection with debt collection, and I don't think the CFPB was opining that you're sending these not in connection with debt collection. What they're saying is if you send it under these forms, under these guidelines, you're protected. You've got a defense. We don't find these to be violative of the cease communication letter. Again, your honors could disagree with that,
but
they have a defense.
But isn't that just about whether it's a violative of the cease communication order and not whether it's a violation of the FDCPA more generally?
Other provisions, correct.
If there hasn't been a cease communication order, then why is that regulation or provision even at issue?
It's really not. That's only, those forms are only for when a borrower, says no more communication. So how does a mortgage servicer comply with TILA when the FDCPA says no more communication? And I think that right there shows the CFPB does not believe that the TILA in any way preempts the FDCPA. They're very much so together. And so with that, Your Honor, I think these statements go well beyond the cookie cutter model forms that were provided. Your Honors have highlighted that. They state amounts that are not due, which is violative of other provisions that are not even addressed by that form. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we think the statements are obviously in connection with the collection of debt, and the district court got it wrong. It should be reversed and remanded and sent down for further proceedings.
Thank you. Court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.
All rise.